Welcome to The Precinct and the Practice, where the conversation is free, but this talk ain't cheap. Broadcasting from a studio in the North CTE Law and Public Safety Center and streaming on NPS Voices, I'm your host, Miss Alexis Love. Consider this your first warning. We're going in. Welcome to episode 4 of The Precinct and the Practice, from the bar to the bench, legislating the practice with our co-host. I'm first the host, Alexis Love. My co-host, I have Muhammad. Would you say hi, Muhammad?
Hi.
In the mic.
Oh, hi.
I have Sanai.
Hello.
I have Nicole.
Hi.
And we have our special guest today, Jameson Whiting, councilman.
It is a pleasure. It's a pleasure to
welcome,
be with you.
Welcome,
welcome.
We are ready to dive in, so
I know.
Let's get started.
That's my gavel.
All right. Well, I'm so glad you made it.
You know I'm here.
All right. Well, we're going to get started. So, Muhammad, you get to start us off today.
And y'all take it. Y'all take it easy on me now.
Don't
y'all
you take it easy.
So, I've done my research on you, and mm-hmm. I saw that you ran for council at Ward 11. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, has running been a challenge for you? And if it has, what ways has that been a challenge?
Yeah, you know, in a little bit of background and history on Ward 11. So Ward 11 is kind of south central Minneapolis. Kind of goes as west as Lyndale on the west side. Kind of on the east side is the east side of Lake Nokomis. Kind of go up to 42nd Street, and then 62 is the southern border. And so you kind of catch Washburn in there, and a few others get Pearl Park, Tangletown, mm-hmm. And other areas. And so running right now is I was just crossed over last Tuesday was my 100th day in office, so we are making it work. But yeah, it's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. So you know, electoral politics is, I think, outside of what humans are and created to do. So you were asking someone to put themselves out there in a way that is asking for support and their voice and their vote, and doing it in a way that is authentic to yourself. And so right on top of doing a job and coaching and all the stuff, right, it makes for a challenging effort and opportunity, but something I would continue to do it again, right? It's one of those things that has been, at least in these last 100 days, has been the most humbling experience of my life thus far. Wow. And getting to do it for the people that made sure that I was on the right track, right? I grew up in Ward 11, and so now I get to serve the ward that made sure I was successful. And so it is both challenging and the most rewarding experience that I have had thus far.
Okay. That's a good question. Mm-hmm.
So my question for you is, what impact has running for a city council had on both personally and professionally?
Well, you should ask my wife that question. It's maybe the main one to do it.
She should have brought her.
No, then you really would have got the truth. That would have came through. Both personally and professionally, I think, you know, it is one of those things, right, where there are sacrifices and benefits to this work. As someone, right, I was in the city attorney's office prior to running for about 2.5 years. Working on all of our police reform work, and how I got to know Miss
right.
Love.
We went to see you last year, and mm-hmm. I remember in City Hall.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I was there for the past 2.5 years before I was elected. Right, and so that was it's a different measure. So you use different skills, and for me, that's been really helpful. Right, it's the first time I've ever had to actually manage people in a budget. Right, the city of Minneapolis has a $2.1 billion budget, and so get to oversee that budget and also manage my team and constituents, right? Ward 11 is about 35,000 constituents, right? And then there's the personal side, right? You know, I was just having this conversation with my wife last night, and we have a baby on the way. We have our first
Congrats.
One.
Yep.
A baby
oh,
girl.
My goodness.
So we are excited. And
her name's going to be Alexis?
Exactly right. Yeah. She'll come out Miss Love.
I know that she will be loved for sure.
Right. And so, you know, it's trying to find that balance. And early on, right, you know, we were put in a stressful situation, right? I thought I was going to be dealing with with snow plows and potholes and maybe a little bit of police reform, right? And had a side of civil war happen right in those first 100 days with the federal operation, with federal Operation Metro Surge. And so for me, it was a kind of trying to figure out how you balance all of those things in a moment that, you know, those there are competing interests for your time. But right at the end of the day, you know, I keep calling, my coach called this when I was called, you got to keep the main thing, right? And you got to make sure that your house is in order before you go out and try to fix anything else. And so right at the end of the day, I'm like, I love my wife. I love my soon-to-be daughter, my family. And so I got to make sure that that thing is as tight as it can be before you go out and step out and try to do other stuff.
Wow, that's good.
All right, my question is, how do you reconcile your background as a attorney with your focus on grassroots and community engagements?
Yeah, so actually, I think it's helpful. The way that in my practice previously, so maybe I'll back up and give you a little more context, was a corporate attorney doing at Fagery Drinker, one of Minnesota's largest law firms, doing M&A, so kind of your deals, you kind of do deals with larger firms, and then nonprofit law as well. And so kind of even at that stage was able to kind of balance both the more kind of grassroots and public interest oriented legal work with your more corporate kind of work as well. And so now moving into this version of community advocacy and grassroots organizing on top of the legal practice has been, I think, really helpful, because at that level, you're kind of distilling legal kind of jargon into actually tangible and kind of layman's terms. And so it's kind of what I do on council and in community as well. It's kind of, you know, you gotta translate all of this confusing and multifaceted work at the council to your constituents. And so it's been one of my favorite things that we have done thus far. Is what I call our scorecard. And right, and so let's say this is the council agenda, right? Here's all the stuff that we're doing at council. My office and my team, we kind of distill it down to, hey, this is exactly why I voted this way. This is what this is going to impact, and this is why we think this is helpful or not helpful. And so if you go up on our website, you can go see, if you just type in Jamison Whiting, you'll see our scorecard. And so it lists every single vote that the council takes. And so I think it has been helpful for transparency reasons, right? It's like, you know, I think the basic and most foundational part of being elected official is communicating to your constituents why you did something or why you didn't do something. And so, you know, leaning into what their voices are, because I think as a job as an elected official isn't necessarily what Jamison Whiting thinks, Councilmember Whiting thinks. It's about what the 35,000 people and their voices in that ward. And I should be a vehicle through which their voices and interests and concerns move forward. So that's a good question.
What are some difficult faces you face against the city of Minneapolis?
That is a good one. That is a good one, right? And I will start, maybe I will start with the federal occupation. I think that is the easiest one to start with, because, you know, it has been an unprecedented effect on our city, right? I think all of us have seen it. You all, I'm sure, have seen the impacts of it, both here in the city of Minneapolis, but broadly across our state and across the country, right? You know, it is antithetical to the promise, I believe, in this country that it was built on, right? This country was built on right, life, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness, and we had the federal government come here and kind of take that away from us. But what I've seen is kind of how our city has stepped up and met that moment, both from you know, an elected position and a body, but also from, you know, the grassroots organizing that we are talking about in the community, right? I'm sure a lot of you have probably seen the larger protests. I think, you know, there was the No Kings rally downtown in Minneapolis. I'm sure some of y'all probably even went to it, right? But there was over 100,000 people in the city of Minneapolis that showed up and said that this isn't okay. And so I think what we are seeing now is kind of the residual effects of that occupation, right? So we have seen, I think, over $200-300 million economic impact just in January, of lost wages, of lost revenue, impacting directly the city of Minneapolis. And so we are trying to figure out how best to kind of weather that storm. for our residents. And so, you know, that is an area, right, we've invested into rental assistance. We've invested into small business support. We've invested into removing fees from our businesses that are applying. And so trying to figure out the best way to help us kind of move back in these avenues. And then you get all the politics on top of all of that, which is a whole other whole other challenge in and of itself. So. Okay.
All right. My question is, in what ways has being an attorney changed your views about law?
Yeah, I think what you learn in law school is how much you don't know. And I think it is really helpful and deeply moving to understand, okay, if I'm reading all of this law, if I'm reading all this case law and legal acumen, to understand that, oh, hey, okay, I don't know all things and I shouldn't be expected to know all things. And I think the best part about being an attorney is learning that and actually having that kind of ego switch of like, no, I'm going to go talk to the people and the experts that actually are steeped in this knowledge and steeped in this area. But the other piece I would add to that is a version of lawyering that allows for being an advocate. I think, you know, what lawyers do, and I think what really good lawyers do, is understand that they are not the client, that we are advocates. And so the job of an attorney is to ensure that you are a zealous advocate on behalf of your client, not necessarily for yourself, right? And so, you know, if Miss Love tells me what to do and she's my client, I got to do it. And I have to do it at the utmost and as zealously as possible. And so I think that is something that you learn really early on. To ensure that you are advocating on behalf of the interest of your client. And doing that in a way, now I get to do that for the city of Minneapolis, right? It's not, again, not Jamison Whiting's opinion. It's the city of Minneapolis and my constituents that I have to advocate for zealously and on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. So I've noticed that you've been pulled over 18 times since you got your license. How does that affect your personal history with the MDRH settlement agreement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So early on, right, growing up in the city of Minneapolis, right, it got my license early on as a 16-year-old. Was driving around. I was usually the kid, the friend that would drop all my friends off after the parties. And so, you know, I was getting home a little later past curfew, right? You know, I was driving in a little bit of a hoopty. We can say that, right? And so, you know, we got pulled over. I think it was, oh goodness, my mom has the exact numbers, but over 10 times within the first 6 months of getting my license. And so, right, some of those, I think, you know, okay, it's late at night and past curfew, right? And I think some of those times are the neighborhood that I was in, the color of my skin and otherwise. And so for me, that was my first really interaction with the Minneapolis Police Department. And so what before I kind of got to the city of Minneapolis and started working for the city, my interactions with MPD were either negative or neutral. And so that's kind of how it framed originally my first kind of instance with policing in this city. And then Wright started working for the city of Minneapolis on our police reform work in conjunction with the Minnesota Department of Human Rights Settlement Agreement, and then started to get around officers and law enforcement officials and started to see and kind of challenge my original narrative of kind of that negative and neutral interactions. And so for me, it was, you know, we have a lot of, I think, officers that are trying to do the right thing and the good thing in policing and protecting our communities here. Mm-hmm. But also, right, it is hard, right? And we have seen historically how policing has been used as a vehicle to hurt Black and brown communities, particularly clearly here on the north side of Minneapolis and then in particular areas on the south side. And so ensuring that we are moving law enforcement in a way that is not continuing to perpetuate those harms, but also understanding that we are also in an area where, you know, I think our Black and brown communities have been both over police and under police. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to ensure that those dynamics and those two kind of methods meet and that we aren't moving off one of the other. And so, you know, it's an area that we have seen in our historically both over police and under police communities that we have to have law enforcement officials that are getting through clearance rates, that are ensuring that they are the times that it takes to go to a call match the times on the south side as they do on the north side. And so, again, ensuring that those biases also don't play out on the over-policing side as well. And so, for me, it has been helpful as somebody that has grown up here, has seen it, has been in the back of a police car, right? But I've also been in the front of a police car now as well. And so I think bringing those and bridging those two gaps is something that we desperately need in the public safety realm and as we move forward in it.
For sure. Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, that's good. So you've advocated for a joint response mm-hmm. model to mental health, right? Right now, we have the Canopy Roots BCR teams handling unarmed calls, and the Hennepin County COPE co-responders pairing directly with officers. So since this dual pathway started in like 2021, how do you determine which practice is actually safer for the north side, an unarmed van or a squad car with a clinician?
Yeah, and I think it's how it meets the individual call. And so I think what we have seen as other cities and other jurisdictions have rolled out these kind of initiatives is it's not necessarily about a specific locale or location. Okay. I think it's specific to each individual call. And so, right, you'll have a different call on the north side as you will on the south side. Mm-hmm. You'll have a different call on the northeast side as you will the southwest side. Mm-hmm. And so what we are trying to do is prepare kind of our public safety ecosystem to ensure that we have the right response for every single call that comes in, right? And so I think, you know, when we have a BCR with our unarmed responders showing up to a person in crisis, right, depending on what that 911 call is and that kind of initial interaction, does it make sense to have an unarmed responder go out, right? And so that's a BCR. With a joint response model, it's kind of pairing a BCR type individual, a crisis intervention specialist, with your traditional law enforcement officer responding to the same call, and you'll have right when you show up on the scene. Maybe it is a person in crisis, but then if that and the initial responder would be that crisis intervention specialist, but if things start to get a little more violent or get a little more tense, you then have that officer there to step in, or vice versa, right? If you have the initial call comes in that is a little more violent, and then you have the initial responder being the police officer, and then if it starts to kind of lower the temperature, you have kind of that crisis intervention specialist step in. And so I think we are trying to figure out how each call, each individual call has the right response. And so I think all of these things, whether that is BCR, joint response model, or just your traditional law enforcement officer responding to a call, I think all three of those are needed. We are making sure that when those calls happen, that we are actually having the right resources go there. And so that even goes into, okay, the dispatch, right? We figured out that we have to train dispatch because when that comes in, how do we actually send out which unit? And if dispatch are the folks that are actually sending those people out, we have to ensure that they are also trained and know which call or which responders go to which call.
And I meant to define it for the listeners and for students. The Minneapolis BCR is the Behavioral Crisis Response Team. So, and they're a bunch of unarmed civilian-led. It's a service that provides specialized support for mental health. Mm-hmm. So that's really significant, I think, because we didn't used to have that. It would just be police answering everything, and then you'd see the results. Like, it would be too violent for certain things when they needed a softer touch. So I think the BCR handles the softer touch well. Mm-hmm. But do you feel like it's improved?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, what we have seen was when they do show up, I think it works extremely well. I think there is a liability piece that we are worried about, right? If you send out an unarmed individual into an area that then increases tensions. And so, but they're trained and prepared for that. Mm-hmm. We have seen a really, really good work and outcomes when they do show up and show up in the correct responses. Mm-hmm. And so it is something that I think we are looking to continue to expand. I know I am, and personally, a large supporter of our BCR in kind of policing traditional law enforcement alternatives, but they all work in conjunction with each other. And so I think we are figuring out how best to use them in partnership with what we're doing, right? Because we have seen, you know, they're understaffed as well now too. And so just like our you know, MPD, right, you continue to put that and pile that on, it starts to thin it out.
Yeah,
and so
people get burned out.
Exactly right.
Okay. How do you plan to measure the success of parent mental health professionals with police in Ward 11?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's twofold. I think there is an interaction kind of measurement and bias and data point of, hey, when you go to a response and you make a call, are we leaving that in a spot better than we are we leaving it better than we showed up, right? Mm-hmm. Are you leaving it in a place that is better than when you first got there? And so, you know, I think Chief O'Hara says this pretty well is, right, I think our public safety responders, our first responders have to be seen as kind of community and customer service first roles, right? If you don't have a good relationship with community before you go out there or when you get there, it's going to be a lot harder to do your job.
And that so, part,
right?
For sure.
And so I think we have to be sure that our officers and that our BCR team and all of our first responders are actually meeting, right? It's the foundational level of basic human respect first, and then doing their job on top of it. But the other way I think of measuring success is kind of on the front end of public safety and ensuring that, right, hopefully we get less calls, that we are kind of getting to the root cause of public safety and crime and mental health in our communities. And so, right, if we are taking care of education, of health, of the workforce, if you have a stable job, you know, K-12 education, and you're healthy, right, we have seen the disparities in the health outcomes be a lot better. And so that also leads to lower crime across the city of Minneapolis. And so when I see kind of like how can we measure the outcome hopefully is that we get less calls to 911 because we are investing in the whole person as well.
That's good. Okay. So you recently suggested delaying millions of dollars in funding for a new police training center, arguing that it might be the wrong time. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, the behavioral crisis response teams have handled over 35,000 calls with an 80% resolution rate without police. And as an attorney and a lawmaker, do you believe the future of Minneapolis public safety is building bigger precincts? Is it in that, or is it in putting that money into more unarmed vans like Canopy Roots? Like where's the draw right now?
Yeah, you know, I think we have to be okay and acknowledge that we can't continue what we have seen previously for generations of policing. And I think that means we have to be okay with starting to rely on our policing alternatives, which is your BCR. It is your neighborhood safety responders. It's your gun violence intervention teams, community violence intervention teams. And I think, you know, we see these things in conjunction, and particularly to the training health community wellness and training center that was proposed, right? We have $38 million community wellness and training center that was proposed, oh goodness, probably about a month ago. And so what we are seeing is kind of jurisdictions that have been moving forward with good public safety ecosystems is kind of doing these things holistically. And so having police trained with BCR, having police trained with other first responders, because that is what these jurisdictions are moving to. And so the community safety, community wellness and training center was a holistic center that didn't just center police in it. And so you had police, 911, fire, EMS, BCR, neighborhood safety, all in one facility. And so I am widely supportive of that. I have been supportive of that. It got into the politics of it, right? We didn't have the votes to pass it. Mm-hmm. And so rather than kind of letting it sort of die on the vine there, wanted to delay it, right? And so, and I think actually with valid concerns from people that weren't supportive of it.
But it sounds innovative, mm-hmm. and it like to me, having that diversity of professions in a building like that training together would put Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis, on a map in a way where I think other cities and states mm-hmm. would like be like, oh my God, what are they doing? Because it, you know, instead of siloing everyone out.
Yeah, and it's and for me, I think what it is the hardest thing to do right on the police reform side, mm-hmm. Right? You can do as much training as you want. You can do as much crisis intervention training as you could possibly do with MPD. The hardest thing to do in any kind of overarching reform and change is to change culture.
True.
And I think that the way that you change culture is getting you out of your echo chambers and your silos, and you get them and you get it right with in any field. You get them to work with people that have different perspectives, different mindsets, different levels of response, and get them in a place where that they are interacting and training with each other. And so I agree with you. I think it is kind of on the cutting edge of public safety. But right, I heard the concerns with people that weren't in favor of that. And so, right, I think we are in a place, it's what I keep calling the tale of two cities right now. And I think there is a place in between that we need to be okay with and acknowledge, right? I think, you know, we can't continue to have a magic number of 10 million police officers is going to end crime in this city, because that's not the way. And zero police officers is not the best way to move forward either. And so I think we have to ensure that there is a balance between both sides and both aspects of public safety. Otherwise, the city won't move forward, and we will continue to see the harms that have been perpetuated in the multifaceted areas of both over-policing and under-policing in this city. And so moved it kind of to delay it so that we can push it back to staff to come up with better engagement policies, give us better specifics of what actually will be in there. That is the best side of that argument that I heard when it was proposed to the city of Minneapolis and to the council members. We didn't have specifics of what that building would actually be. And so when we say a holistic building, right, is that 95% MPD and 5% to the other alternatives, mm-hmm. right? It shouldn't be, in my opinion, but there was no specifics about that actual kind of build out of the building. Right. And so I think that is what, you know, when it comes back to us, I think a lot of us are looking for, of, hey, what will this actually entail? And will this be a holistic version of public safety in Minneapolis?
I feel like we need to take that leap and just, mm-hmm. I mean, we've hit rock bottom a few times.
Yeah.
And we there's nowhere for us to go but up, but we really need to struggle to get there.
Like, yeah.
Anyway, go ahead, Mohammed.
You've opposed rent control. What specific policies will you introduce to ensure missing middle housing is actually affordable for current residents?
Yeah, well, I haven't opposed rent control yet. It hasn't come in front of me. I think there is a versions of rent control that are beneficial. I think a broad version of rent control, as we have seen kind of in other avenues, I think in certain places it works. I think like a city like Minneapolis, there is a tailored version of it that could possibly work. But specifically to ensuring, I think, missing middle and housing outcomes is we have to build more housing. Right. And we have seen that the more housing that is built, the lower the kind of average rent comparatively. And so Minneapolis, I think we are in the top 10 of some of the largest cities in the country and based on kind of like our housing affordability. And so we are one of the best in the country for housing affordability comparatively to other large cities. But we have to do better, right? And I think we are seeing this version of kind of an affordability crisis that we are seeing kind of come up in New York and L.A., but also here in the city of Minneapolis. And I think the policies that we need to do is ensure both, I think it's twofold, right, of ensure that this is a place that housing development happens. And when those folks come in, both on the affordable housing front and kind of your at-market developers can and should develop here in the city of Minneapolis. But then also ensuring that we have tenants' rights and kind of those policies in place that support our renters across the city and enforce them. I think what we are seeing is Minneapolis, again in Minnesota, have some of the best tenants laws and policies across the country, but we have to do better at enforcing them. And so that's what I think for me is kind of this enforcement mechanism to ensure that we are doing those really, really good things that we have done at the state and here at the city. But also I think it's right ensuring that we have to build housing, right? If you build housing of all types, it ensures that that missing middle has a larger capacity to actually have people move into those homes.
Okay. Well, we have one more official question. Before I ask it, I'm going to define what commercial corridor revitalization is. And it's the process of improving underutilized, deteriorated, or disinvested commercial streets and districts to enhance their economic vitality, safety, and aesthetic appeal. Okay? It's making your neighborhood better on all fronts. So with that being the definition, as someone who's raised funds for local businesses post-COVID, post-2020, how do you see that experience shaping your approach to commercial corridor revitalization?
Yeah, and it's, I think what we are seeing is we have to ensure, again, whether that is in a regulatory scheme or on the policy front with council and on kind of the government side, is that we are ensuring that for someone that wants to start up a small business, so when all three of you start up your law firms on in cultural corridors, hopefully in Ward 11, I will be advocating and lobby you all for that. We have to ensure that it's easy for you to do that, right? That the permits, the licensing, the setup, the rent that you have to pay in those abilities aren't too overburdensome. And so I think the city of Minneapolis and what we can do is help on kind of that regulatory side to ensure that, hey, when you do kind of come up and say, I'm ready to start my business in this cultural corridor that we haven't seen investment in, that we make it easy and effective and streamlined for you, right? What I have seen kind of on this side now is, right, it's a process. It's a process you have to go step through step through step, which is good and helpful. But sometimes I think it is we have been doing the same thing for a very long time, and it's the easiest way to do that, but it's not necessarily the most effective for our small business owners, the people that want to start businesses and kind of revitalize these corridors. And two, I think we have to have people back in their areas and in their corridors and walking around and engaging and one that has to be safe, right? If it is not safe, right? No one is going to walk there. We all know that. If you see it and it looks like you don't want to walk there, you're not going to walk there.
Sure.
And two, it has to be accessible. And so I think that means green space. It means it has to be close to where your home is. And so I think it is both a density issue that we have to ensure that we are not seeing massive urban sprawl, but actually making your homes kind of this missing middle conversation that we just had, that your homes are attached to where these corridors are, that these kind of all different types, row homes, condos, apartments, that they are all intermixed into each other so that you can actually show up and go to the flower store down the street, the grocery store on the corner. And so I think that is an area, right? And we have to, again, make it a place that someone actually wants to come in and invest. And so when you all go off to law school, you want to be like, I actually want to come back to the city of Minneapolis and invest in this place and invest in my community. And think that that is an area that we have to do better in, both on the regulatory side and making it actually, again, the foundational things that make Minneapolis the most special place in the world continue to be that.
For sure. Well, all right. That was good. You got through.
We made it. I'm only sweating a little bit. I know you guys got a round robin lightning round, too. That might be
We're getting ready
harder.
To go into our lightning round. Y'all ready? Because I think that Councilman needs to be shaken up a little bit more.
All right. So. Okay.
All right, y'all. I'm not going to do the first one, but here goes. Here are the rules. I say 5 seconds. You want to give him 5 seconds or 10 seconds to answer? Five. Yeah.
I got five.
We only got it for a little bit longer.
If I was a polar, y'all would have gave me 10.
Wow.
I'm seeing it. The wasp and trap on here. I'm like,
Yeah, you get 5 seconds, Mr. Miller. So you can't overthink. You just have to tell the truth.
Say it.
Okay?
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay. Which feels more satisfying to say in the courtroom, objection or overruled?
Overruled, for sure. Absolutely.
Okay. A latte from the Get Down Coffee Company or a standard cup of black coffee from the community meeting?
Just because I know Houston will probably be listening, I got to go with the Get Down Coffee latte.
Okay. Which is more exhausting, a four-hour city council budget hearing or a two-hour football practice?
Yeah, if it's with my girls have been great. The boys, oh, I'm like, I don't know if I can coach them anymore.
Oh, my goodness.
All right. What was the very first job you ever had that gave you a paycheck?
Oh, the Limited. I worked at an all women's store for middle aged professional women. I didn't know it was an all women's store when I applied for the job. So
that's funny. Who is number five? Ask the question, boy.
All right. So, favorite Minneapolis park to clear your head after a long day at City Hall.
Oof. Gold Medal Park.
Okay.
Yeah, right downtown. Stunning. Walk the dog there. It's a good spot.
What's the best local business in Ward 11 to grab a quick lunch?
Oh, that's rough. They're going to get on me if they hear that. I know. I'm like, Heather's. I really love Heather's.
I do too.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I have a great salmon BLT. It's okay. Really good.
All right. Windows up in silence or windows down and music while driving through the city?
I'm windows down in silence. I'm windows down
that.
In silence.
He just, what?
Windows down in silence.
Oh,
yep.
I thought you would have said windows down and playing music.
I'm like, it depends on the day. Today, I'm going to have windows down and music pumping a little bit.
Okay.
I pull up to City Hall and I'm like, okay, let me kind of code switch a little bit here.
Okay. What's got number eight?
What is the best piece of advice you've received from a coach?
Oof. Best piece of advice. Leverage your youth, right? I think for you all, leverage your youth. It is an area, right? You will never be this young again. And the moment you start getting older, people think that you want something from them. The moment that you guys are right here, you can go into any single room in the guise of learning. And so continue to leverage your youth and be in those rooms that you're supposed to be in. Because, right, without your all voices, I keep telling people, I know I'm going past my 5 minutes, but or 5 seconds. But we continue to talk about our young people like you are our future, which you are, but you're also our present and in this moment as well. And so continue to bring your voices to the present, because I think it is extremely valuable in the way that policymakers move forward.
That's good.
All right. And then my last question for you is reading a 100-page legal briefing Reading a 100-page legal briefing or watching 3 hours of film?
Game film.
Game film. Yeah. Game film. Easy. I'm done reading. I don't want to read anymore. I'm like, I've had it with all the reading that I've had to do.
What is one book every NERF High student should read before they graduate?
Oof. The Color of Money. The Color of Money is a really good one. The Color of Law kind of goes with The Color of Money is a good one. My professor at law school wrote it, so shout out to
him. Can you give a brief description of what it's about?
So kind of The Color of Law kind of speaks to redlining. The Color of Money kind of talks to how our financial institutions have kind of done the redlining of banks and financial institutions. And so it's a really, really good read.
That's good. All right. Well, be honest. Which looks more intimidating on a cold Friday night, orange and black or blue and white?
I'm like, we all know the Tigers. I got a lot of respect for our Tigers, but I mean, the North Polars have been on the top for a reason.
For sure.
But
for
I think it's the orange and blue gives a little more fright than
orange and
else.
Blue. Orange and black, you mean?
No, orange and black is South. Orange and blue is Washburn.
I know. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Okay. I see what you're saying. Oh, you went there. That wasn't one of the options.
I know. I'm like, I gotta. I'm like, if you cut me open, Miss Love, it's gonna come out orange and blue. I'm sorry.
Okay. So, you're a Miller by blood, then.
Mm-hmm.
But you're coaching. Well, so you're not coaching Polars now. You're coaching Millers.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So this is wrong. But if it's a tie game between North and Washburn with 10 seconds left, who are you secretly rooting for?
Oh, I'm like, it's not even it. I'm like, that's not it. I'm like, I probably have a Miller tattoo on my back. I'm like, it is. The moment we get out of the conference, the moment we get into the intersections, it is Minneapolis pride through and through, and I want us all to do well. But I got to rock my Millers.
I got to. All right. You know,
my wife always says if I had to represent any other high school, luckily, Washburn is the only high school in Ward 11. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think I could do it if I had to represent any other high school.
Well, good for you. You did a good job. They'd be proud of you. I hope they listen to this. I'm going to make sure I'm sending it over to somebody at Washburn. Play this on the loudspeaker at the high school. So yeah,
Dr. Palmer is leaving. Our principal over at Washburn is leaving. She has been fantastic, but I know we're going to get another good one coming through.
Well, thank you for your time. Do you have any questions for us?
No. Thank you all young folks for being here and doing it.
Anybody want to ask any last lingering question that isn't on the agenda? Well, then we are done. So now we can harass you off camera. Thank you.
That's what it's for.
Thank you.
Thank you.